Blog Talk Radio.
Conscious Capitalist is a show that centers on the mission of Conscious Capitalism, an international organization started by Whole Foods co-founder and CEO John Mackey and Michael Strong. By featuring businesses who use business to elevate humanity, the Conscious Capitalist show focuses on spreading the awareness of the Conscious Capitalism business framework and core principles of higher purpose, stakeholder orientation, conscious leadership, and conscious culture. Conscious capitalists are entrepreneurs and business owners who endeavor to create financial, intellectual, social, cultural, emotional, spiritual, physical, and ecological wealth for all their stakeholders. We are committed to making a positive, measurable difference in the world. Your host for the Conscious Capitalist is Christopher King, who goes by King. King is the president of the D.C. chapter of Conscious Capitalism and author of the new book titled Connecting with Intent, Why Social Capital is More Valuable Than Financial Capital. He is the founder and CEO of King Connections, a benefits corporation that is a business leveraging consulting firm that specializes in developing innovative, customized business systems. King Connections helps clients connect with intent to build, manage, and leverage social capital to create high-value, connected, engaged communities. King is the co-founder of the Conscious Success Academy, an online academy for empowering individuals to become mentally and financially free. King is a community activist and leader and is a board member of the Montgomery County Housing Partnerships. King is a writer, speaker, problem solver, and self-claim leveraging connector who believes that happiness in life is when you love unconditionally, serve dutifully, and live with intent. Ross Girardi, Vice President of the D.C. Chapter of Conscious Capitalism, founder and managing director of Conscious Management Consulting, a firm that is dedicated to improving the world by upgrading the organizational cultures and leadership of businesses, government agencies, and military units. Ross is committed to great corporate cultures in the world. His noble cause is to help his clients move forward while remaining in alignment with the core values of the organization's employees. To this end, he is aligned with and operates from his own core values of moving forward in integrity, authenticity, and commitment to higher purpose. Ross believes that everyone has meaning, purpose, and something unique to contribute to the world. He is committed to assisting his clients with unleashing the great gifts of all employees. Ross is also the co-founder of the Conscious Success Academy.
And Ross, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Doing great, King. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great as well. Another beautiful day. Another beautiful day to be alive, to tap into the infinite possibilities that this day has to offer, and just happy and blessed to be alive and have the ability to continue to love and receive love today.
Mm. Love that, King.
You know, I know our listeners are excited about our show and our format of interviewing successful, conscious thought leaders. And with that being said, who is our successful, conscious thought leader today?
Well, King, today we have the pleasure of Bill Cumming joining us. And Bill has originally spent 13 years as an adjunct faculty member at the University of Maine. He helped the university's Aspirations 4 school project. He was a key partner in the New Horizons Academy and developed trustee effectiveness training and was the corporate responsibility officer for what is now KeyBank nationally. Bill is a founding director of the Policy Institute for Public Education in Maine. He is the creator of Motivation, What Works, Power Within, and What One Person Can Do courses, all of which encourage loving kindness, ownership, responsibility, and teamwork. And Bill is a 30-year coaching veteran. He has been a coach, consultant, and trainer to CEOs and the executive teams of healthcare delivery organizations, business, school systems, and nonprofit organizations. He is also a coach's coach to some of the most successful people in the field and was an integral part of the curriculum development for Coach U, the original coaching training program in the United States. His work focuses on creating inspired environments where individuals take responsibility for their lives and the organizations for which they work. So with that, Bill, we'd love to welcome you on the show today.
Thank you, Ross. I always listen to that and I go, who is that? Anyway, whatever. Yeah. Like when you get that old, you know, it's like, come on, let's get to the chase here. Thank you. It's good to be here. I have something going on with me, so I just want to throw it out. It'll probably skew everything, but I want to be outrageous if I may be.
Yeah.
Do I have permission to do that?
By all means.
All right. Well, I've been doing a lot of thinking recently in the last few weeks about those 300 youngsters in Nigeria. Mm. And I am in the process of contemplating whether I can set up a way for myself first, but maybe 299 other people to go and put ourselves in the place of those 300 children. We got to stop putting children as the bartering chip for any kind of world situation. And I'm sorry, but it's just the most important thing on my mind today. And I don't know how to do it or whatever, but I'm exploring it. So I guess ultimately for me, conscious capitalism means taking responsibility of a world that works for everyone, not just some of us. And right at the moment, it feels to me like we got just some of us down pretty good.
Wow. You know, Bill, that's why, you know, I know I'm definitely excited to have you on the show. Because, you know, what you just shared is absolutely right. That is living the principles of what conscious capitalism is all about. And I remember that last week my mom came to me and she was so upset because she felt that no one was talking about it at that time. You know, and she had an article and she was really looking at ways to try to get more awareness and get people to discuss it. I know they were discussing it at her church, but she was really passionate about it and really wanted to make sure that people knew and we're discussing the children who were kidnapped in Nigeria. And so just so happened, I guess, through prayer, like the very within 3 hours, you know, of that, of her making those statements and making that request of me of how we can get more information about it. Next thing you know, Fox 5, it came on Fox 5, then later on CNN, then the following day it was on The View, and then everybody began to talk about it. So I admire everything you're saying, and I would say that as busy as my life is and as much things that I have going on with my goals, that I'm with you. If you want to be one of 299, I will join you as well. Again, we don't know how to get it done, but I think we can tap into our resources and make it happen.
That's really exciting. That's great. I think talking about it really does make a big difference, King. It's down to 298 now, so that's terrific. We'll see what happens by the end of the day.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that we really want to, because you just gave our listeners an excellent intro into who you are as a person beyond the bio, you know, so they can really see what type of character you are. And I think the fact that you stated that one of the most important things in your mind right now is that, you know, that is so interesting because as I talk to most people, with the exception of my mom, that's the only other person that's mentioned that to me in the context of that being important to them. And again, I'm not saying it in a judging context, only as in an interesting type of fact context. And then when I get on social media and when people who do bring conversations to me who are, I would say, friends of mine who are not, quote-unquote, within the ideology of a conscious capitalism mindset, their main concerns or main conversation they're bringing to me is this elevator video recording with Jay-Z fighting with his wife's his sister-in-law that they dominate the media with, or maybe the Donald Sterling incident and these other incidents like that that really have no real intrinsic value to who we are as individuals. But those are the things that are dominating people's thoughts. That's their dominating thoughts. And so it's refreshing to hear someone that's willing to say that it's busy. And I know I have an idea of how busy your life is and what's managing your organization that we're going to get into. But for you to say that's what your most dominating thought, I think it's really fresh. I think it's really admirable of you. And I just think that, again, that's why I strive to connect with souls and spirits like yours that I can learn from and grow and help keep me grounded and lets me know as far as I've gone, there's still far for me to go. So with that, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, King. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, with that being said, that's my long worded way of saying, our first question I want to ask you is, tell us about the Boothby Institute and what's the story behind the Boothby Institute? I love talking about stories, and if you wouldn't mind sharing us the story behind the Boothby Institute.
Not at all. I spent a fair amount of time, 10, 15 years, doing traditional things, King. I had the privilege of helping found Upward Bound in Sedalia, North Carolina in 1964, or being one of the people that helped found it. There were three different pilots. But from there, I became a teacher, an executive director of a YMCA, the head of a foundation, a school man, and then I became corporate responsibility officer, as Ross said, for KeyBank. And it was at that time that one of my children was raped. And I want to fast forward to 2014. My daughter is now the chief communicator for the Veterans of Foreign Wars for the state of Massachusetts. And she's an amazing person, and I'm very prejudiced in her behalf. But on that day, I discovered that I also have capacities inside of me that I'm not proud of, one of which is that I have the ability to kill. And I know it because of that day, because on that particular day, I would have killed the man who did that if I'd caught him. And I'm not proud of that, but the fact of the matter is that once you know that you have that capacity, whether by involvement in the military or whatever, however it is you discover it, you know you can't put it back in the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I also realized that that made me exactly like the rapist. And so I started to look at exactly where violence and damage comes from in the world. And I'm going to make a very long story relatively short. Phil Donahue used to have a great television program back in the early days before trash TV. He would have been one of your favorite conscious capitalism people, King. Anyway, he had a man named Nick Groth who ran the sex offender program on his television program, and he had three admitted murderers and rapists on the program, and it's what I didn't hear that got my attention. I didn't hear one of them laying responsibility for anybody outside themselves. I did not hear anyone being blamed. All I heard was people who now recognize that they were taking responsibility for their own lives and choosing to do what they could to contribute. And so I called Nick Groth on the phone, and I said, I need to understand how you're doing this. And he said, the only way you're going to understand this is to come down here. And so I went to the maximum security prison in Somers, Connecticut. And once you're inside a maximum security prison, you really are aware of where you are. You've given up your keys, your wallet, your chains, your sunglasses, because they can be made into they're a sharp instrument, your belt, et cetera. Anyway, it wakes you up when you're inside. The first people that Nick introduced me to were people that he had just started working with, and he asked them to say how they thought they got there. And the list was the usual list. It's what I'd expected on the television program. Mom, dad, the judge, the lawyer, teachers, some radio talk show host. They couldn't say who, you know, I'm teasing, but you know, everybody was on the list, anybody they could think of. And then they finally got to the place where one guy said, yeah, and if the gal hadn't done this, I wouldn't have killed her. And I must have had the same look on my face I did on the day that Joy was attacked. But the fact of the matter is that I knew it was time to move on, and so did Nick. So we left that group alone. And we then went to talk to a group of inmates that he'd worked with for a couple of years. And in that group was one particular individual who, as a child, was locked in the closet for 10 days at a time. That's where he ate, slept. That was the bathroom. And when the children weren't locked up, they were being raped and sodomized by the entire adult community. And he was one of the people who had been on the television program. And at the end of that first day, he came to me and he said, Bill, I am sorry that your daughter was raped. And I knew he meant what he said. I didn't know what to do with it, but I knew he meant it. So what came together for me over a period of months was that the capacity for everything, great goodness, great kindness, and great damage, real damage, death, destruction, verbal destruction, etc., is inside of all people. The question is what we water. So I began developing programs for institutions who wanted to set up a ground of being, if you will, a foundation for operating with dignity and grace and loving kindness, and then going about the business of their work. And I started with schools because it was the arena that I had the most experience in, and we started training folks. When I was at the University of Maine, we probably had about 4,000 teachers go through the course that we called Motivating the Unmotivatable, the entire title of which is a lie. There's no such word in the English language as unmotivatable, and I couldn't motivate you if my life depended on it. But it attracted people, and we were able to award credit through the University of Maine, et cetera. And as we went along, people heard about it, so I ended up with a friend inviting me to work with a hospital, and then somebody else invited me to join in with their prison program, et cetera, et cetera. So it just evolved, King. It's all been word of mouth. It's impossible to describe the nature of the work because it's different for every person. It's not about me talking, you get brighter. It's about having a conversation about how we're going to treat each other as human beings.
Wow.
Well, Bill, I'd like to say, as King knows, but most of the listening audience doesn't know, I'm very familiar with the Boothby Institute and really can never say enough good things about the work you do. But I wonder if you could just speak a little bit about the programs of the Boothby Institute, what's available, and what that entails.
Sure. Well, there are two kinds of work that's available, Ross. One is what you did and what most people have done over the years, and that's we have a 12-week program where people gather in no more than groups of 25 together, and we work through a 12-week process that involves four basic ingredients. First of all, there are 9 basic principles that go with the work that I roughly described a few minutes ago. I could read them if you want me to, but I won't for the time being. So we take the 9 basic principles, and then people add their own goals, which they share with me, but not necessarily with the group. And each week, we work on experiential processes that allow them to discover that they're a lot more capable and powerful than they think they are. And you would think that discovering how powerful one is, et cetera, it would be a highfalutin, mostly intellectual conversation. It's not. It's very pragmatic and very simple. I ask people to do things like pick the chore they hate doing the most. I won't do it with you right this second, but if I asked both of you to tell me which chore you disliked doing the most, the assignment would be to then go home and do that chore with energy, enthusiasm, and as if it were the most important job in the world. And everybody laughs at that. The room that I got the most outrageous response was I was talking to the senior faculty at a college of education once, and I told them that the secret to motivation had to do with their toilets, and then I gave them the assignment. And they didn't think it was funny, and I didn't think the fact that they didn't see the humor was funny either, because if you're a teacher and you can't clean your toilet with energy, enthusiasm, and as if it were the most important job in the world, I suggest you better not tell students to study spelling that way, because some students think spelling is about the same as cleaning the toilet. It's not about necessarily liking everything we do. It's about what attitude we bring to it. Young people spend a whole lot of time in school. The question is what use they're going to make of that time. Anyway, so that's one aspect. I ask people to do self-care, which is to acknowledge three things daily. We live in a miracle. Everything is interconnected, and the only thing I can do anything about today is decide what attitude I'm going to bring to the day. I ask people to pick a case study, somebody they're going to work with for 12 weeks, somebody who's struggling, somebody who they know in real terms. Nobody in the room knows their name. It's all anonymous. And lastly, we talk about what are hot topics. What are the things that are going on in their lives, whether it's a business or a school or any kind of experience that they're involved in. And we talk about things that are working and things that are not. And so what comes of that is an experiential and very personalized process that allows them to discover that they can really take charge of their own lives. And once you realize that you can take charge of your own life, you want everybody around you to do the same thing. For example, if you want an administrative team that's really good at sharing ideas and people being excited about sharing new ideas, you don't judge and evaluate those ideas based on the first communication about them. You thank them for their contribution. And if you really want people to tell the truth, it has to be okay that they tell the truth about you, which means they may not like some of the things you do. Well, that doesn't have to have anything to do with whether I support and honor you as a person. I may not agree with everything you do, but I can still treat you with dignity, grace, and loving kindness. So that's a 12-week process. The other way I do this is one-on-one with people on the phone, an hour of my time a week. They have access to me for 24/7, still 12 weeks. People always ask me, well, why don't you put it in a weekend? You can't do this in a weekend. This isn't about me talking, you get brighter. This is about what's already inside of people. It has to be an evolution. They have to discover it inside of themselves. And lastly, as you guys well know, I'm in the process of just about completing an online version of the program, which we're going to call What Every Person Can Do. And we plan to launch that relatively soon, and we're hoping to develop a cooperative relationship with the Conscious Capital Academy in moving forward. We don't have any idea what that looks like exactly, but so those are the three things that we're doing. One is alive by group, one is one-on-one with me, and the other will be an online version where there'll be one big general call, but there might be 100 people on that call, so it's not going to be, there won't be the time for the personal interaction. Does that cover what you intended, Ross?
Yeah, very much so, Bill, very much so. And
okay.
As you were describing the program, I was reliving some of those great experiences, including the one of doing the chore with energy and enthusiasm. And in my case, I cleaned up the entire basement within like an hour, and I procrastinated on doing that for a long time. So it was beautiful, beautiful.
Well, you see, the thing is that until somebody does that, they've held that chore for a long time. They said they wanted to do it. Most kids want school to work, but they don't get that it can be different than the way it's been, and a lot of them decided they didn't like it a long time ago. There are probably 20% of students who actually don't need teachers. All they need is resources, and they do well. There's probably another 20% of kids who have got so much stuff going on with them that they don't know what day it is. They don't know whether there's enough food. They don't know whether there's shelter. Issues of alcohol, physical, verbal, sexual abuse is going on. There's another 20% like that. There's 60%, by the way, if we don't take care of those primary needs of that 20%, we're never going to make schools work really anyway, so we need to get over thinking that this is just about books. In the middle, you've got 60% of the youngsters, some of whom have just not gotten engaged, some of them who are sometimes engaged, and some of whom are just putting their bodies there. Until they discover that they can go do that chore in an hour that they've been dreading for months. And by the way, every time you sat down to take some leisure time when you weren't cleaning the basement, what did you think about, Ross?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about that was burning up energy because I knew it was something that I was avoiding doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And the longer things like that get put off, the easier it becomes. And so students start handling all academic work that way. It's not that most students aren't bright. It's that they bought into the fact that they weren't bright. They do things as if they couldn't do it. They bought into the notion that they're not able. Not true.
Hmm. You know, Bill, as I listen to you, and, you know, I know I'm just, you and I are really just beginning to grow our relationship. And I noticed you shared some stories with me before that really just, again, spoke to your integrity and spoke to you and your character as a person that I knew that I wanted to be connected to. And so with that being said, and you've done marvelous work throughout your life. You've had some major traumatic experiences, and you've overcome those. You've turned those traumatic experiences into powerful life lessons that you were able to grow from. And so I know that this next question that I have for you is one that you've put a lot of thought into, and this is definitely something that from a level of wisdom that I want our listening audiences to really hear, because this is, to me, is the crux of what conscious capitalism is really all about. And that is, what is the higher purpose of the Booth B Institute, or your higher purpose as it relates to you as an individual?
Very simply put, for us to exchange love for hate, to come to a place where we recognize that this is about 7 billion of us, that we actually can coexist, and that what we don't need is to find other ways to fight each other. If we take the energy and effort that we're putting into beating each other down or having the weapons to blow each other up, we could solve most of the major problems in the world. Jeffrey Sachs, who's an economist, says that, and this is old statistics, so it's a little bit out of date, but he says that right now we spend about 0.3% on foreign aid. And if you ask most people in this country what we spend on foreign aid, they think it's in the percentages, if not double-digit percentages. 0.3% is accurate. Sachs believes that the monetary impetus necessary to turn around all of the issues that have to do with world famine, housing, potable water, etc., could be solved if all of the industrialized nations contribute 0.7%. What I'm about, King, is deciding for us to have this be a world for everyone. And how that looks in corporations is, I'm all for competition. I don't think competition is bad, but I don't need to screw somebody over in order to be successful. I don't have to put somebody else down in order to be successful. I think treating people with dignity and grace and loving kindness is the ultimate higher purpose. And if I'm not doing that, then whatever else I'm talking about probably is not too important. We go through a lot of activities. You were talking about the social media and everything right at the moment, King. We go through a lot of activities that are not particularly significant, while we don't recognize and haven't been focused on the needs of people all over the planet. And unless we solve the problems that exist, and when I say solve the problems, I don't mean us being the solution. I mean us being willing to be partners with the people that are affected, being the solution themselves. We finally wakened up to the fact that this is not about us going in and fixing everything. It's about time. When I first started working in the issue of world hunger, Buckminster Fuller had been talking about sustainability for a long time, but everybody missed it. They didn't pay much attention to him until in relationship to world hunger until Werner Erhard, who's a self-help guy, out and started EST and the Hunger Project and a bunch of other things. John Denver and Harry Chapin started the Hunger Project. The primary purpose of that was to create the will to end hunger. Well, that was in the early 70s, and we're now in 2014, and the number of people dying of hunger and starvation is about half of what it used to be. Not bad work, but the fact that there's still half left is ridiculous. It could be solved in a very short period of time. The other one of Jeffrey Sachs' statistics that I love is that by 2013, guys, by the next 16 years, we could actually end hunger and starvation and housing and potable water issues as a global society if we set about it. So for me, if that's not the higher purpose we're up to, what if the purpose of school isn't to create more humane, compassionate, understanding, successful, celebrated people, I don't know what we're doing. Anyway, you get the idea.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Bill, your background, as we've already mentioned, is very broad and extensive. You've been in education, you've been in the nonprofit world and the business world. And I'm just curious, what would you do differently if you were going to start all over again?
It's kind of interesting. My father once said to me, you don't ever want to do that, because if you change one thing, you change the entire thing. That said, there's a mistake I've made a number of times, and that's not making sure that the CEO or the governing board or whomever was on board when we got started. Let me explain why that's so critical. In one school system, not where I was doing my work, but a school system where I became a board member, I made a deal with the negotiator for the teachers union that we would have this school system be the highest paid school system in this state. And I never wanted to hear the words again, "It's not in my contract." So we set about it. I got the board to go along with it. The faculty we signed it. And over a period of 6 years, two things happened. The first one was that little town became the highest paid teacher salary in the state. And number two, if I had asked the teachers to go to Alaska the next day, all they would have asked was, "What do we need to pack?" It was really amazing. It was great. But the fact of the matter is now, 6 years, you know, not six, it's closer to 20 years later, there's none of that spirit left. It needs to be maintained and nurtured by the people who control the institution, and they need to be called to account for whether or not they are operating with a higher purpose, so that, for example, we don't ever strive for mediocrity. We had a school superintendent here in the state who said, "My goal is to have 90% of the students who graduate from high school be literate." And I went, "Well, wait a minute. What about the other 10%? Why would you do that? Why would you say that we're going to have 10% of the people who aren't going to make it?" Anyway, I guess the single idea is, if you don't have the senior people, the board, the CEO, whatever, on board, you can do whatever you want to do at a programmatic level, and its chances of being long-standing and institutionalized over a period of time are diminished, in my opinion.
Amen, Bill. I totally agree with that. I've seen that many times.
So do I.
So, Bill, here's something, and just so everyone, I went through your program, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago now, and one of the really beautiful pieces of it is something called self-care, and I've continued that now every day, every morning since you first introduced me to that idea, and I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit about that and let people know what that's about.
I will, and I want to tell you where it came from. I was discouraged at a particular time, and I was walking around this particular evening, and please don't hear this like I think I've spoken to God, but I was walking around, and I have had for years a voice in the background that talks to me about things I ought to be paying attention to and looking at, and it is the voice of a black woman, and she says to me from time to time things that I need to be looking at. And I'm sure it's a familiar voice, but I can't figure out who it is. But the fact of the matter, maybe it's King's mom, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that the voice says very important things to me. And in this particular evening it said, "All right, you're discouraged. Why don't you read what some other people have written about this and do it a lot of it?" And I'm going, "What does that mean?" Anyway, so I started, I read the Bible. I'd been exposed to the Bible growing up, but I was not a terribly religious person, so I read one version of the Bible. And when other people that I knew, I told them that I was reading the Bible, they gave me their version. So I had the King James Version, the New Modern Version, this, that, and the other thing, all kinds of different religious sects. I then started reading the Quran, the Tao, the Bhagavad Gita, the original teachings of the Buddha. And what I found, Ross, was that they all point to the same thing. When you put down ideology, personality, sexism, all kinds of things that are contained in all those documents, they point to learn to grow in love and wisdom and love one another better. So I started to think, okay, where do I experience my connection to people? And for me, since I was a small child, going by the ocean has produced that result. I don't know what it is. But when I'm by the ocean, I just sense my interconnectedness with all beings. Some of my more sarcastic friends would say it was that I was a fish in a former life. But in reality, I get that water evaporates and that it goes into the air and it rains and it grows the trees. I rent a very small apartment, but it has a beautiful 10 feet wide, 5 foot high window that overlooks a tidal basin of the North Atlantic. And at high tide, there's 10 feet of water in the backyard, and at low tide, there are clam flats. 10 feet of water, and I can see a mile of water until we get to the next peninsula corner. That's a huge volume of water that goes in and out every day, predictable 100 years in advance to the minute. That's miraculous to me. Mm. The universe is expanding, they estimate it, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000,000 miles a second. That's miraculous to me. And what's miraculous to me about that is, you know, the train wreck in Italy where that big train was going 140 miles an hour and went off the tracks? It destroyed everything in its path. If we're expanding at the rate of 1,000,000 miles a second, we ought to be grateful that in this second we're still here, because if one small thing goes wrong, this whole cat box is going to get upset. We ought to be grateful. Anyway, so the last piece of it is that the only thing I can control is what I do today. So whether I'm with thee by the ocean or not, I remind myself of three things. One, we live in a miracle. The fact that we can talk about loving kindness on the radio and caring about people, et cetera, is incredible to me. Two, that everything is interconnected. Everything I do, you do, counts. And third, the only thing I actually control is how I'm going to be today. And when I remember those things, and then I read three pages or two pages of a booklet I put together a while ago called Care of the Soul, which is really just a way to look introspectively at the power that exists inside of us, that for me was given to us by higher power. I don't get too carried away with what that higher power looks like. I'm quite content with the black lady, if you get my drift. And the fact is, though, that when I remember that for me, when I do those things and reflect and I look at the capacities that are inside of me, then I generally make myself a much more purposeful day than if I simply wait to see what the day brings me. So that's what I mean by self-care, Ross. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah.
Mm. You know what, Bill? Each time that you give an answer, you spark about 10 other questions in my mind. And, you know, I had another question that I was going to ask you, but I'm going to change that question now because something else came to me that was, I believe is much more a more profound question, and that is, I'm curious to see, what is your definition of love?
Okay. Love has a real meaning for me. And it's not the stuff that you see on soap operas or in romantic novels. If I bring you a child who's 8 or 10 years old that has no family or parents or whatever, a child who has no economic advantage, nothing going for them, would you want that child to starve?
No.
No? Would you want that child to be homeless?
No.
No. We'd want that child to be able to create a meaningful, productive, contributory, joyous life and have the tools necessary to do so, wouldn't we?
Definitely.
That's what I mean by love. And I literally include 7 billion people in my thoughts about that every single day. It's not something I talk about euphemistically. I think about 7 billion people. That was a very big number for me to get a hold of. But when I'm in touch with it, I actually can't talk, because I can imagine exactly what it looks like and feels like when we actually have a world that's for all 7 billion of us.
Mm.
And by the way, it doesn't mean sacrifice, but it does mean, and I do say it to people, if you are without food or shelter or you don't have a place to live, and I can be of use and I have it at that moment, it's yours. And there have been people that have taken me up on that. I think loving kindness has some responsibility. It's real and tangible, and it means something to me.
Hmm. I love that answer, by the way.
Thanks, King.
Yeah. You know, kind of related to that, Bill, and I just want to, you know, the work that the Boothby Institute does that you do, you're, you know, working with prisoners, homeless people, students, religious organizations, corporations. It's a very diverse group. How is it that resonates with all these different groups?
It evolves absolutely, totally spontaneously by people who have been involved in the work. Let me give you an example. The guy who first talked to me about the notion of self-care was a guy named Ron Browning. And Ron and I had a client in common that happened to be Coach U at the time of, you know, when they got founded, and we were working on it initially. And we were walking up a mountain out in Steamboat, Colorado, and he looked over and he said to me, what do you think about the people who live in that housing enclave over there? And I had no idea how many people lived in that group of houses, maybe 2,000 people. It was pretty big. And I said, quite frankly, Ron, I don't think much about it at all. He said, well, I'd like you to think about what would happen if you held them in a place of loving kindness. So you can see where that started. That's Ron Browning. So Ron Browning, we didn't talk for a while, and then we met up again, and he called me, and he said he had a friend who happened to be the head of a hospital, and he needed some work done, and would I be willing to work with him? And I did. And then that took me to Renown Health, which is the biggest healthcare system in Nevada, which was a client last year. I got into prisons because when the first teacher that I had in Maine when I came to get my teaching certification was a guy named Keith Cook, who lives up in Waterville, and he's still a clinical psychologist, and he was teaching a clinical psychology class, and I took his class, and we ended up with a great lifelong friendship. But when he started working on work in the prison, the first person he thought of was me. So it's all, Ross, in a matter of word of mouth. I'd like you to think about how you advertise what we've been talking about. One of my very dear friends is a guy named Bob Miller, and Bob was one of the original members of DHOC's marketing team when he came up with a Visa card. And Bob Miller used to be head of marketing and a senior vice president at what became KeyBank. It was Cleveland Trust and Ameritrust when Bob was there. Anyway, Bob said, it's the only thing I know of that I can't market. Most things I can market, but this I can't market because for all extents and purposes, you refuse to promise people anything because you tell them it's already inside of them. So now you're going to come and pay me to find out that all of this stuff is already inside of me. And I go, yep, that's exactly right. you don't sell people things by saying, nope, this is already inside of you. Well, the fact of the matter is you do when you tell the truth about it because it is already inside of all people. That's the great gift that we've been given, and we absolutely refuse to get it. If you'll forgive me a story about the first summer of Upward Bound to demonstrate this, when we first started that program, we obviously did a lot of testing before and after, and the IQ scores of the kids in that first year, there were 60 of them, went up an average of 17 points, and the college board in New Jersey went berserk. They said, that can't happen, it's not possible, this, that, and the other thing. Accused us of all kinds of stuff. We got the same response as Jaime Escalante got out in Los Angeles. That's the guy who did Stand and Deliver. Anyway, make a long story short, they found out that we'd done everything properly and that the scores did rise. What happened was that group of kids had been told by their peers and their parents and other people and prejudiced folks and this, that, and the other thing that they weren't as bright as white kids. And that was not the truth. They were incredibly bright, but they'd bought into the fact that they were not bright. They were surrounded by inspired people, took education seriously, and when they took the test the second time, the way they took it was markedly different. That would have made up for 17 points if nothing else. I don't know how much they learned in 6 weeks, but what shifted was the way they viewed themselves because they were around people who knew that they were incredibly valuable and bright. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I needed to tell that story, but I did.
Well, Bill, I think it's instructive because what you said a minute ago was that the power resides within everyone. But I think what you do, what you figured out how to do is uncover all the junk that's covering that up so it can come out and shine. And that's the art. That's the service that you do.
Well, I give people an opportunity to clear up that junk. Yeah. I do.
Yeah.
But there isn't a process. It happens naturally. When people are treated with absolute and unconditional loving kindness. And I contend you can tell by the tone of a person's voice whether they're grounded or not. You can't fake this. This is one of those things where, in my opinion, it's like if somebody says to you, happy birthday, Ross. No, it's not about happy birthday. You may not know what it's about, but it sure isn't about happy birthday. And a lot of people say really the right words come out of their mouth, but when they say it, it curdles the cream. You know, you don't know what's wrong, but there's just something wrong. Well, when kids get that they're surrounded, or anybody, adults, this isn't limited to young people. The only reason that anybody does anything that's damaging to other people is they don't feel well about themselves.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. After 9/11, I said, why don't we find out why 11 people wanted to have flown planes into that building and kill 5,000 people who had nothing to do with anything? They're trying to get somebody's attention because things aren't right in the world. And do I support that way of doing it? I certainly do not. But the fact of the matter is there are a whole lot of people who haven't been listened to, and we need to wake up. Anyway, I get wound up. This thing it's restricted to an hour.
Well, you know, shifting the focus for a second, Bill, I want to ask you a question about one of the things that I do as a consultant. So my business is really about building relationships and building stakeholders, relationship management systems for my clients. And within that, you know, strategic partners are part of those stakeholders. And so my question is, how important do you view strategic partners with helping the Boothby Institute to execute its mission? And do you also have a process in determining what strategic partners that you will work with?
The answer to the last one is no. But how important are they? Incredible. I wouldn't be anywhere unless people had been talking about this, and those are all my strategic partners. The fact of the matter is their experience is what carries this, and I support them and support their work as well. Do I think it's important? I think it's critically important. The one thing that I can't do, unfortunately, King, is I can't pick people who don't have an experience of this work. Now, that's not a con job to get somebody to go through the process, but if I don't have people who understand what actually being grounded and living out of a place of loving kindness is and not being apologetic about using the word love in a business place, I can't work with that, okay, because they don't have the faintest idea what I'm up to. And, you know, as obviously from today, if you give me a microphone or an opportunity to talk, I'm going to talk about what I perceive to be the most important thing right at the moment while I'm being as responsive as I can to the questions that you're asking me. So the answer to the question is my strategic partners. Ross is on my board of directors. All of my other people who have been on my board, the people who have been through the work, they are all the people who have moved it forward. Without them, all but one of the people I have ever worked for are still in communication with me. And that was just a person who absolutely, you know, did not understand, thought I was way off in left field. And from his point of view, I was off in left field. I was a Y director, and the first thing I did when I moved into Northern Maine was there were some Native American migrant workers, and so I gave $400 worth of scholarships to the Native American kids. And the first time board meeting I went to, I was asked whether I had a representative group of Arista County youth in the camp. And that wasn't because they thought the number was right. And, of course, given that kind of challenge, I said, well, no, I think I'll double it next year, you know. So, anyway, I don't necessarily make friends with everyone, but losing one boss is not too bad a record after 50 years. So those strategic partnerships are incredibly important to me, King. And I wish I didn't have to say the thing about if you don't understand this work, we can't do it, because this isn't something that you put on sometimes. You have to live out of this work. And it's interesting because you can feel it when people are wanting to live out of it, but it's not quite there. And anyway, I'll stop talking.
Well, you know, Ross, I know we got about approximately 7 minutes left.
Yeah.
And if you wouldn't mind just talking about conscious capitalism, describing that so we can discuss conscious capitalism a little bit before we have a break today.
Well, okay, so there's four major kind of pillars of conscious capitalism, one which we've already talked about extensively is the organization has to have a higher purpose. It's got to serve something bigger than just making money. The second piece is conscious leadership. In other words, leadership that is conscious and is, you know, again, setting up the business or managing and leading the business accordingly. The third one is stakeholder orientation. And really what that boils down to is all of the stakeholders, anyone that touches the business or an organization, their needs are taken care of. So in the traditional business model, which we call traditional, it may not really be that traditional when you look at it, but it's there. The bromide is to maximize shareholder value. Turns out that's not really how it works, and it's the businesses that are practicing stakeholder integrations that are actually end up being more profitable anyway. And then the fourth aspect is conscious culture, and that's the culture of the business. Every business has a culture, but within conscious capitalism, it is, you know, is the culture itself conscious? Is everyone awake and aware, and you know, do they have the freedom to do what they need to do to deliver excellent service, for instance? So those are the four pillars, King. And I'm wondering, Bill, does any of those kind of stand out for you in terms of...
Well, one of them does, only because I know the guy named Henry Sherrill is the one who came up with the conscious leadership piece, I believe. He and Bob Greenleaf wrote Trustee is Servant, Servant is Leader. There was a series of three books that was about leading profit and nonprofit organizations written in the 70s. And I don't know why Henry Sherrill's name doesn't show up, because I used to meet with Bob and Henry in the Commons in Boston, and we'd sit from time to time and talk for 3 hours. Very interesting people. Each one of these things, in my opinion, Ross, is critically important. If you don't have a purpose that is bigger than delivering the widgets, you don't get why delivering the widgets on time is important. If you don't have people awake, there's no way you can include all the stakeholders. And when you actually include everybody who's involved, my father used to believe that if you don't take care of the people who do the investments, the people who manage the business, the people who are the labor force, those three parts of the internal business, and take care of your customers, you're bound and determined ultimately to fail. Because we didn't listen to that stakeholder orientation and ownership is what caused the financial crisis of 2008. Nothing less than that. Mm-hmm. And conscious culture, no way in the world, if you're not going to be conscious and tell the truth about stuff, you're going to do the kinds of things that we're talking about.
Exactly.
Well, great. Exactly. Yeah, exactly, Bill. Very right on. That's awesome.
Well said. And now, one thing I definitely want to make sure that we have an opportunity to give our listening audience the ability to get in contact with you. So I want to make sure that you have opportunity to let everyone know the web address, email, phone numbers, or any other method of communication you want to share with our listening audience. Any upcoming events, feel free to mention that now.
All right, I'll do it quickly. The website is www.theboothby, B-O-O-T-H-B-Y. Institute.org, www.theboothbyinstitute.org. You can reach me at 207-442-9867. And the web, my email address is bill@oneperson, spelled out, oneperson.net. That's it, and appreciate the opportunity, King. Ross, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we're not ready to wrap up yet, quite yet. I just want to make sure that we didn't rush through that important part. But we do have an important question to ask you that Ross and I always ask each of our guests on our show, because, again, conscious capitalism, from our standpoint, the way we go about it within the DC chapter of conscious capitalism, is we believe in helping our strategic partners, our stakeholders, grow and develop. And so with that being said, the question I have for you, what is one of the ways in which what are some of the ways in which DC Chapter of Conscious Capitalism can assist you with executing your mission and helping you spread love and kindness?
Okay. The first thing would be is to be in a place of loving kindness. Do whatever you have to do to get to that place. If you have things to heal, places to take care of, do that so that every interaction you have with people comes from a place of loving kindness, no matter what else you do. Two, if you seriously are interested in getting into a conversation where you establish for an organization this kind of climate that we've been talking about, call me, write me, you know, get a hold of me, talk to somebody who's been through the work. And that's the way you can support us in moving forward. But it really doesn't take us. This isn't about the Boothby Institute. Are we a player in the arena? I hope so. And the fact of the matter is this is about nurturing and promoting the idea of loving kindness and the possibility of a planet that works for all 7 billion of us, not just a few.
You know, Ross, I would definitely say this, that Bill, we always get to a point where, you know, some of our guests leave us to the first hand. We definitely want more, and we wish we had more time. And, you know, there are so many more questions that we definitely want to get to that we're not going to have an opportunity to do, obviously, because we have pretty much seconds left in the show. Well, we would love to definitely have you back on our show and have you share some more of your stories, because that, to me, is one of the, I say, ways that we can grow as individuals, is by learning from the wisdom of others. And you definitely have and possess a lot of wisdom, so we definitely want to tap into that.
Well, thanks very much, King. I'd be honored to do that. And I look forward to, you know, working on things as we go along, so thanks.
So with that being said, we have 10 seconds left in the show. And again, we want to thank you, Bill, for being on the show. Ross, I want to thank you again for being the co-host, and thank our listeners for tuning in to the Conscious Capitalist. Until next week, everyone continue to live with intent, discover your higher purpose, and be conscious leaders.